Please help me welcome our speaker, Kim from Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah, dim the lights and all. That's great. That's great. I'm having a panic attack, just so you know. It'll be over as soon as I allow a higher power to speak through me. My name is Kimberly Ann Package, and I am a recovered alcoholic. And hi, everybody. And I am sober today through God's grace, a 12-step design for living, and a wonderful, wonderful fellowship of the Spirit in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I am on fire with gratitude. I just want to tell you that I get really scared every time I tell my story, share my experience, strength, and hope. And I probably have said this on many, many other occasions. It's not about the number of people that are in the room, although that is staggering. I think that it's really about rendering myself vulnerable in front of a group of people, because how it works demands rigorous honesty. And I'm supposed to share with you what I was like, what happened, and what it's like now, what I'm like now. And in that, I feel like I have to bare my soul to, you know, many, many people who although, you know, what comes from the heart reaches the heart, and one alcoholic sharing with another is without parallel, and I know you get me. It still scares me a bit. It still scares me a bit. And I think that goes all the way back to what I was like. And I was terrified that you wouldn't like me. I was terrified that you would reject me or not believe me or not want to be around me. And the loneliness and despair that I felt that was so deep and so painful in my life, I never want to return there. I was reading Facebook today, and a friend of mine had posted up there, thank you, God, for my laughter, but never let me forget how I cried. And I really feel like that today, like I can stand up here right now, and I can jump for joy. And I really want to thank Big Dave for asking me to speak, because I love this man. I love so many people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really feel connected, and I really feel honored and privileged to be just among such really good, good, decent people, you know what I mean? But man, I cried. I cried, and I was in pain, and I was in pain from as far back as I could remember. You know, for this alcoholic, booze was but a symptom, and I really needed to get an understanding of the underlying causes and conditions in a way that I can ask my God to remove them. And I gotta tell you that you'll hear me talk about God. You'll hear me talk about God all through my, you know, of myself I am nothing. The Father doeth the works. That's just how it is for me. I don't apologize for that. I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it gives me permission not to apologize for that. In fact, it gives me instruction never to apologize for that. It says we never apologize for God. We let him demonstrate through us what he's capable of doing. And when I tell you my story, it goes without saying that he is capable of miracle after miracle after miracle, and the hits just keep on coming. Like, that's just what my story entails. So I can tell you that I'm excited about my life. I don't like where I'm at right now, and I'll just want to tell you the truth. You know, that whole destruction of self-centeredness, man, it can be really painful. And although I'm a real big, you know, I'm a proponent of the Big Book, I like the essays by Bill Wilson, too. And in the 11th step, it says, through every season of grief where the hand of God seems heavy or even unjust, new lessons for living are learned, and new sources of courage and strength are uncovered. Man, I'm probably going to be like a superhero by the end of this bout. You know what I mean? I'm like, you know, because I just feel like I'm being, you know, my friends and I were talking about it on the way, you know, on the way over here. Growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, I heard somebody else say it. I won't coin it as my own, but I will borrow it. And some of the smartest things I've ever said in my life came from somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, growing up in AA is all about growing down. It's all about subtraction and ego deflation and reduction. And boy, I'm telling you, he's got me in a spot. My God's got me in a spot. But I know, you know, I know that that's how they make gold pure. they stick it in the fire, and then they stick it in the fire. And then when they're done that, they stick it in the fire. And so, like, I just feel like I know it's going to get much greater later. And when I come through this period of change and transition, I'm going to be repositioned to let him take me where he's got to take me. And I'm excited for that. I am looking at my watch and wishing he would hurry up a little bit. But me and him have never been on the same page time-wise. You know, I've always been like, he's always been like, when are you going to do what I want? And I've been like, wait a minute, I'm not done here yet. And then I'm like, when are you going to do what I want? And he's like, wait a minute, I'm not done here yet. Like, that's where he's at, you know, and I'm not done. And I'm at this spot where I'm in a lot of transition. So I don't want to stand before you and act like, you know, I'm on a spiritual and moral hilltop. I'm in the valley, but I still have the joy of living, which is the theme of our 12 steps. I still wake up and hit my knees and say, thank you, God, that I am alive and I am sober and I get to see another day. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to serve you and serve the people around me just however you want me to. Just the opportunity to serve, because I was so selfish and so self-centered. Now, do I think I was evil? No. I don't think I was an evil person, and I think my selfish and self-centeredness was birthed out of fear. You know, I love the big book. It says we run on 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-delusion. Like, I was running on all that stuff. And so my self-centeredness and my selfish decisions, you know, we made these decisions based on self that later placed us in a position to be harmed. They really had, like, there was a method to my madness. There was really a method to it, because I was so broken from a little girl that I would have done anything for love and affection and acceptance and comfort in my own skin, just to be okay in my own little person, that I had no choice but to act selfishly and self-centeredly. That's just my experience. You know what I mean? I didn't know. I don't think you can make a decision at 5 or 6 or 7 to be, you know, deviously self-centered in that way. So, yeah, if you can, I'm open to being wrong. You know, over the years, my story has changed. And I should probably mention that my sober date is January 23rd, 1994. And my sponsor is Claire Keller. So I can tell you that I've been trying to, you know, work with a higher power to figure this thing out for a long time. So my story has changed over the years. And I think, man, was I lying? No. I'm just growing, and I'm my thinking is being readjusted. You know, alcoholism for me centers in the mind, and my thinking was really sick. You know, the doctor's opinion says maladjusted to life, in full flight from reality, and an outright mental defective. And I can promise you, I was like that from 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and I hated myself. I was too skinny. I was too ugly. My clothes weren't like your clothes. My parents' house was not like your parents' house. Although I had really no idea what your parents' house was like, in my mind, your parents' house was normal and mine was not. You know, I come from alcoholic parents. I can say that because my father identifies himself as an alcoholic today. He's been sober since October of 1992. And you'll find out in my story that that's how I came to be dropped off in Alcoholics Anonymous, through the grace of God, working right through my dad. And so, you know, I don't know. I just, my mom, she was a flaming codependent, and she qualified for a seat in Al-Anon probably long before she qualified for a seat in AA. She just probably qualified for a seat in AA because after a long period of time, when you can't beat him, you join him. So that's what happened. She couldn't beat my dad, so she joined him, and they both drank themselves into oblivion. My father has had the benefit of having access to a 12-step design for living, and my mother has not. However, I love them both in such an incredible, mystical, and magical way today that I am free from any resentment. You know, I don't have guilt, shame, or remorse in their presence anymore. I don't feel vengeful. I don't beat them with the club of guilt and anger. Like, I just don't live there anymore. Thank God. I mean, you can probably hear me say that. You'll be leaving here. Like, if she would have said thank God one more time, I was going to scream. But, like, I mean, like, I absolutely know that I did not do any of this. God put me in the boat. I rowed. Believe that. I rowed. But he put me in the boat. because I just could not break free of this agony that I lived in. I was full of fear and I was insecure and I had no self-esteem. And I know a lot, I don't know how men relate to this, but I know how women relate to this. You know, I was looking up to see low self-esteem. And I just did not value myself as a little girl, as an adolescent, as a preteen, as a teen, as a young lady. I just didn't. And my actions were in line with that kind of thinking. You know, I didn't value myself. And I wanted to, but I just didn't know how to do it. You know, so I'm this mentally obsessed physical allergy. I believe for me, I know alcoholism is a self-imposed crisis, and I know every drink I took, you know what I mean, got me to the bottom. Because I don't believe every drink I took got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I totally believe that there was an act of divine providence that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But every drink I took certainly took me to the bottom of where I lay. I'd like to say of where I sat, of where I, you know, where I stood. I laid. By the end of my drinking career, bent over from this spiritual malady, this mental obsession, this physical allergy, crippled in a corner of the bedroom, in my own bedroom, locked behind a door, not feeling worthy enough to sleep in my own bed, sleeping on the floor in the corner, crying out to my God. So I want to tell you that I'm living, you know, with these alcoholic parents, you know, codependent, alcoholic. There was lots of stuff happening in my household when I was coming up. There was originally three of us. My older sister, Dawn, she's about a year and a half older than me. Then myself, my younger sister, Carrie, 3 years my junior. Later, there came three more. But like when I was coming up, there was so much craziness going on in my household that, you know, I was full of shame and I was full of fear and I was full of just pain, just crippling pain. So I didn't know what to do with it. I certainly didn't have an environment where I could say, I don't know why I feel like this. You know what I mean? Mom, Dad, you know, something's going on. It really wasn't like that. And the truth of the matter is if it was available to me, I wouldn't have tapped into it. Like, I just wouldn't have. I had that loneliness and I had that secretism. You know what I mean? That secretive lifestyle that I just was not going to tell anybody how I felt, because then you would judge me and you would think I was crazy. And I certainly thought at 6, 7, 8, 9 that I was crazy. So I didn't want you to confirm it for me. You know what I mean? And I thought, you know, some things are better left unsaid. And so I'll just kind of live with this. And I tell you, this is how I operated on this little street in South Philadelphia. That's where I grew up, Front and Mercy. There was a couple little girls, a couple little kids on the street, and I used to go out to play with them. And because I hated myself so much, and I really desperately wanted you to like me, and I didn't know the whole psychology of it and why I thought if you liked me, then, of course, I was okay. I don't know how that, you know, played out then, but I do know this, that I dishonored you from the moment I met you, because I was never honest with you, never. I said, I love your hair, I like your skirt, do you want my candy, do you want to eat at my house, you can pick the game, you can go first in the game, you know, just like anything. I just manipulated you so that you would then think I was great, then you would like me, then I could relax and breathe easy, and everything would be okay. Now, how do you figure that out at 6, 7, and 8 years old? You know, so can I be really devious? I don't really know. You know what I mean? Like, that's the truth of it. I don't know if I was devious. But I do know that it worked for a little while. And I love that part of the big book where it talks about before you experience the third step, being the actor, wanting to run the whole show. Forever trying to arrange the lights and the scenery and all the players so that what happens, the show goes off great. But in reality, the show doesn't come off very well. And so even from far back as 6, 7, and 8 years old, I was trying to arrange everything so that the show would go off really well. And it didn't work. And I didn't get that it didn't work, or I got that it didn't work, but I didn't get that I needed to do something else. I just redoubled my efforts. And I gave you more of my candy. And I, you know, I just let you tell me what to do while we were playing. And I just, you know, it just was crazy. It was like, I think about it now, and I feel sad for that little girl. No wonder I drank. You know, who could live with that? You know what I mean? I couldn't live with that. Pain, shame, embarrassment, humiliation, you know, just crippling anxiety. I couldn't live with it. And but I did have it figured out, or at least I thought I did, on Mercy Street. And then my father got hurt down the Longshore. And he used to work on the docks as a longshoreman, and he got hurt, and he settled, you know, with his company, and he got a lump sum buyout. And as an alcoholic would have it, he bought a bar, and he realized his dream, and he bought a bar, and then he moved us on top of this bar, which meant new neighborhood, new school. You know, new home, like new. And in my selfish and self-centered state, I was like, oh, my God, this is awful. How could he do this to me? Like, I had to go to a new school. I had to figure out the lay of the land again. Who do I let pick the game? Who do I let go first? Who do I give my candy to? How about my pretzel money? Like, who do I have to be afraid of and stay away from? Who do I have to? It was just awful. Going to school, you know, was worse because there were about 30 of you in the room with me. You know what I mean? Like on the street, it was like 7. I could kind of, you know, maneuver my way around before I was exposed. But 30, you know, somebody's bound to figure you out. So school was much worse. And it was so bad. I mean, I was so consumed with this fear and this self that I didn't learn anything throughout my education. Here I was with the textbook, and we're going around the room reading, and I'm like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. This is my paragraph. I'm going to have to study this so I could read this. So what happens when it comes to me? I read it wonderfully. You look over at me, and you think, wow, she's brilliant. And then you want to hang with me. Then I'm in. Then I can breathe. What usually happens? The show doesn't go off very well. And the smart kid reads 4 paragraphs. Now I got to start all over. Oh, my God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I learned nothing. When I tell you I learned nothing in 8 years of grade school, in a couple years of high school, 5 high schools it took me to not graduate from 10th grade. I can tell you that. I can tell you that. They told me I didn't have enough credits, and I thought somewhere along the line I had to earn these credits. This is my 5th school. But no, I didn't have enough credits, so I did what any brilliant young entrepreneur in the business of sales, selling AA non-conference approved materials, would do. I quit. So I left high school, and I was probably about 15 or 16. And you know, I want to tell you that that was like my school experience. But I lived for like a Friday or a Saturday because I was drinking. I had my first drink when I was probably about 8 or 9 years old because my mother and father would go out after a Saturday night. It would be 3 deep at the bar. I mean, on every side. The jukebox was blaring, echoing upstairs. I just was so drawn to the excitement. Now, remind you, I was never unhappy. 52 of the big book describes me when I hit that and I talk about the bedevilments. I go, oh, my God. I was a walking bedevilment. Like, I was full of fear, and I was unhappy, and I had problems with personal relationships. If you're 6 and 7 years old and you're bribing somebody with a piece of candy, you definitely have a problem in your personal relationship area. It got worse when I hit men, you know what I mean, or boys. It got worse, let me tell you. It was bad in family relationships. It was bad in friendships. Like, I cried my eyes out reading this big book thinking, thank you, God, that there is an instruction manual that identifies me, that I can then, you know, walk through this process with a really, I don't even know how to describe Claire Keller to you, and I don't know if you have met her up here, but when I tell you she is a woman of grace and dignity and honor, and she was patient, and she was kind, and she was loving, and she was compassionate. Like, there is a debt of gratitude that I have to my God for putting her in my life, and to her for walking me through this process that I believe I can never repay, no matter how many women I take through this process. So she gets nuts when I talk about her name, and she'll hear this CD and be like, you did it again. And I'll be like, yes, I did. I never apologize for talking about God, and I never apologize for talking about the woman who took time out of her busy, busy schedule to meet with me and give me a blueprint for a new life. That's just it, she just put my hand in God's hand and I was reborn. How do you honor that? How do you repay that? You just don't. But I want to go back to where, like, I had these three deep. There was these three deep people at the bar. And I was so drawn to the music because I was crippled and unhappy. I don't ever remember smiling. I never remember smiling. And if I did, it was short-lived and it was fake. That's just the way it was for me, from as far back as I could remember. I laughed at your jokes, you know, that kind of thing, because I wanted you to like me. And I remember sneaking down on a Friday and Saturday night and watching and peeking from the stairs, just ever so, you know, I wouldn't be, you know, just inconspicuously so I wouldn't be noticed, and I could see what was going on in the bar. And what I saw was excitement, was camaraderie, was laughter. It looked just like happiness. It looked like happiness. And I had never felt like that. And I never really looked at it the way I did those nights, staring down, you know, from those steps. I never really saw it like that. And I saw them with a drink in this hand and a cigarette in this hand and a smile from ear to ear. And I thought, I just got to get my hands on that drink and that cigarette and I'll get to be happy. So probably at about 8 or 9 years old, when my mom and dad would go out, they would close the bar at 2. People would hang back. They'd probably drink till about 3. They'd go to the after hours club with their friends. They would come back and they would, you know, pass out, and they would be sleeping. And I would be downstairs in the bar, and I would be putting the credits on the jukebox from the back, and I would be tasting all the liquor and anything that was sweet. I'd be pouring it into some glasses, and I would be stealing quarters from their quarter box and going over to the cigarette machine. You know, I'm aging myself. I turned 40 this year. And so I can tell you, fabulous at 40, I'm not scared. So I'm like, but the cigarette machine was really old. Like, now it's very quiet and it takes dollar bills. You know what I mean? Then it took quarters that seemed to weigh a ton and to make so much noise on the way down that I would walk to the cigarette machine and I would drop a quarter in, holding onto the Marlboro red handle, you know, with my ear cocked to the stairway to make sure that I didn't hear anything. And I would put a quarter in, and it would go all the way down, and I would listen, and I would put a quarter in. It was probably like 75 cents or a dollar. Then I would pull the handle out, and I would listen. Then I would walk it back in so that it didn't make any noise, because they were like, cha-ching, ba-bang, you know. So, and the cigarettes would fall, and I didn't even know how to inhale. But I was smoking a cigarette, puffing away, and drinking booze. And I love, in the doctor's opinion, where it says the sensation was so elusive that we couldn't differentiate the true from the false after a time. And I got to tell you that although I couldn't put my finger on it, something happened to me when I took that drink and I smoked that cigarette. And I spun around on that bar stool, because remember, I was like 8 or 9, so I would get a little buzz on it. I'd be like, flipping around. I had arrived. Bill Wilson did a tune of hundreds and thousands and millions. I was like 8, 9 years old on a bar stool, sipping like grenadine or, you know, sweet vermouth or some crazy concoction, and smoking a cigarette. But the booze that washed over me made me feel like everything was going to be okay. I was going to be okay. Therefore, everything was going to be okay. And I can promise you, silently and unknowingly, I forged a relationship with alcohol at that point that you were going to have to pry it from my dead, cold hands. Like, that was my solution. Alcohol was not a problem for me. It was my solution. And I drank because I needed a solution to how I felt. I drank every weekend when my parents would be passed out. Then I began to progress. You know, the big book talks about this getting worse over time, never better. It's a progressive illness. So by the time I was 10, 11, and 12, I was stealing from my parents' beer box. And it was quarts then, not 40s. They came around a little later. And I would steal quarts of Budweiser. And I would wrap them in some clothes. And I crossed over at that point from, you know, innocently trying to get people to like me and to to being a little manipulative and devious and dishonest, disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. Like that's, you know, I crossed over somewhere. As my alcoholism was progressing, my behaviors were also getting worse and worse and worse. It was almost like a parallel process for me. So I would steal from them, and I would tell them I was going to stay at a friend's house. And I would go stay at a friend's house, not the friend I said I was going to, because the friend I was really going to, I wasn't allowed to go to, because, of course, they were the problem, not me. My parents were oblivious to what was going on. And I don't know how, but I can tell you honestly they were oblivious, because when I shared my experience, strength, and hope for the first time, my father sat in the back of the room and cried his eyes out. And his words to me were, "Where was I when all this was going on?" Like he was stuck. So I drank from 10, 11, and 12, and I was drinking quarts of beer, and I was hanging out all night, and I had learned how to inhale cigarettes, and so it was on. And I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous what a resentment is, but I traced back when I can recall having my first real resentment, like one that I really could sink my teeth into. And I remember being at Greenwich Street Park as a little kid. And I don't know why they called it a park. There was really nothing in it. It was like one bench and a tree. But we would go there. And I would be in my Catholic school uniform, or if it was in the summer, I'd be, you know, I mean, I was a little girl. I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And we would all chip in, and we would go to Miss Mickey's. By the time we were about 13 and 14, you know, we were hitting the speakeasies for alcohol. And in Philly, they're a dime a dozen, and you can go there literally with a note scribbled on paper in your own handwriting saying, you know, your mother sent you here for a 40, and they would sell it to you. So, you know, like that's really where I was at, you know, with a note scribbled in my own handwriting. Don't even know if I spelled Budweiser correctly, but she sold me to 40 anyway. And I remember taking these couple 40s back with these young girls that I hung out with and sitting in Greenwich Street Park, and I would take a giant pull off of it, and I would give it to you, and then I would immediately cop a resentment because you were taking too much and you were taking too long to pass it to him so that it could get back around to me. Alcohol had me in its grips, and I didn't even realize it. Like, I didn't know. I knew that I was alcoholic early on. I didn't know what it meant to be alcoholic. People would say to me at 17 and 18 and 19, "You're drinking again?" And I'd say, "Yeah, that's how I'm alcoholic. That's what we do." Like, I had no idea that alcoholism was a disease, that it could kill me, that it was progressive, incurable, it was fatal. I had no knowledge of a mental obsession, the physical allergy. I did know that I didn't drink like regular people. Like, I knew that I would be going to the bars underage, and I'd be hanging with some of my girlfriends, and they'd be like, "I've had enough." And I was like, "What? Are you kidding me? You're going home. Go ahead, beat it, you lightweight." You know what I mean? Like, I was just aggressive, and I was angry, and I was, and I don't know when that happened to me. Like, it happened along the way, because all I wanted to do was like other people, love other people, have a good host of friends that were not fair weather, and just be. I just loved God. My whole entire life I loved God. I knew God when I was 6 and 7 years old, and I would sit on the back steps of my mother and father's bar, and I would say, "God, I don't know why I feel like this. Can't you help me? God, why am I thinking like this? God, what is wrong with me?" Like, I talked to God my whole life. I didn't know how to listen for the answer. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that if I could clean away the wreckage of what was going on with me, resentments, fears, sex conduct, harms to others with the emphasis on sex conduct. Like, I didn't know that once that was gone in a fifth step, that my Creator could just enter me and then we can just walk together. Like, I didn't know anything about that. And my family didn't know anything about alcoholism. My whole family is littered with alcoholics, but they didn't know treatment. Nobody ever said detox or rehab or counseling or nothing like that. Like, it wasn't, you know, my family just didn't know of those kinds of, you know, solutions and or efforts, you know what I mean? For this real alcoholic, apart from divine providence, nothing was going to be able to help me. So, but they probably would have tried some of those methods had they known about them, but they really didn't know. And so I drank. And I got drunk, and I blacked out, and I passed out, and I came to. And I want to tell you that my 8-step list was really long. Like, that's where I'm at. It was really long. I hurt people. I dishonored people. I degraded myself. I allowed other people to degrade me. I really suffered. I love in the big book where it says alcohol takes women down harder and faster, because that gives me permission to just be kind to myself, you know, and just be, you know, I mean, I know that the literature says harder on us, softer on others, but I felt so dirty and so unworthy. Like, that line in the big book just allowed me to say, okay, Kim, they know about this. And if it's here, then other people have experienced it, or they wouldn't be telling you about it. So just be, let God do his thing with you, and you'll be okay. And so I want to say that I continued to drink. I continued to run through jobs, which were never really anything, you know, to write home about. You know, I worked in corner bars. I worked in bars on South Street. I worked in bars in Atlantic City. And I just, like, I didn't, you know, I was a low-level peddler, so to speak. You know, in my mind, I was going to come up behind the likes of Tony Montana, but I was like a nothing. You know, I had a magic magnifying mind, and I was really delusional, and it funded my drinking, because I am a real alcoholic. You know, I know some people get involved with other things, and the doctor's opinion talks about that. He says we can't use alcohol in any form at all. So I know they're talking about homegrown alcohol, powder alcohol, you know, injecting alcohol. I know they're covering the bases. But I drank a fifth and a half of Cuervo, lots of long neck bottles of Bud, and any kind of bottles of wine I could get my hands on. And I could not eat. I could not hold down food. I could not hold down alcohol. And I would drink and vomit and drink and vomit and drink and vomit. And then when I would drink and it would stay down, I'd say, oh, good, now I can eat. But not too much, because I don't want to drink on a full stomach. Like, that was, I mean, I was literally insane. You know, the 12 and 12 says, glass in hand, we warped our minds into such a destructive obsession for drinking. You know what I mean? And, like, my thinking was a mess. Like, just to make that statement, when I hear myself say it back, I'm like, I don't want to drink on a full stomach. Like, that to me, I'm like, what were you thinking? And I absolutely knew that my life was unmanageable. In fact, my life was pitiful, and it was pathetic, and it was shameful, and it was unsuccessful. I could not face life successfully. I could not be in relationships successfully. I could not be in jobs successfully. I was not a coworker among coworkers, because if you were there 15 minutes longer than me, I wanted your position. I wanted your status. I was just, ugh. I don't even think there's enough words to describe how sick I was. And I don't even mean that from an egotistical standpoint, because I don't think I'm, you know, the sickest of the sick. I definitely know I qualify to, you know, I'm up there, but there's people right along with me, so I'm okay with that. You know, I've met them, and they've been kind enough to share their experience, strength, and hope with me. So, like, I'm telling you that I was a mess, and I drank 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, unless I was passed out. And I did not know that I was going to die. I did want to die. I did not actively think of suicide, but I did think many a days when I came to, God, why did you wake me up again? Like, the laundry list of grave harms that I had done to people, I couldn't look in the mirror anymore. The way I was living my life and how I felt about myself as a human being and as somebody who believed in her heart that she had so much potential, but couldn't figure out how to, you know, make a difference in her own life. I just couldn't look at myself anymore. I couldn't live with myself anymore. I had moved myself away, and a bottle of booze and a man brought me to my knees. And I say that because I earlier stated that I degraded myself and I allowed other people to degrade me. And the bottom line is, my thinking was, right out of More About Alcoholism, the methods we've tried, I thought if I just had the right job and I just had the right guy and I just had the right set of circumstances going on, everything was going to turn around and I'd be okay. And I moved from encounter to encounter to encounter. And I used to say from relationship to relationship to relationship. But the truth is in my delusional mind, it was going to be a relationship. And we were going to be in love. And we were going to be married. And we were going to ride off into the sunset. And his love was going to be enough to help me to feel like a whole and worthwhile woman. And I just got worse. And so a bottle of Cuervo and a man brought me to my knees. And God saw fit to pick me right up out of that. It was January of 1994. And I really probably hadn't seen my family in a long time. And for me, who is very connected with her family today, a long time is probably like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months, somewhere in there. I hadn't seen my family. I hadn't really talked to them. I took so much from my family, and peace of mind was at the top of that list, because my mother had resigned herself to the belief that she was going to open up a paper or see on the news that an unidentified female body was left beaten, sexually violated in an alley for dead, and that she was going to have to figure out whether or not that was her daughter. And so I can tell you how I was living. And, you know, I called it Dayton. I called it Daytonum. You know what he called it, right? Okay. As long as we're clear on that. I don't want to use profanity, man. I love God. I don't want to go crazy, you know. So the thing is I thought I was dating him. I was not. I was delusional. And, he was a drummer in a band. And I'm telling you, my head, you know, he had long hair, biker jacket, drumsticks in hand, you know, sharing one with a bottle of booze. And I thought, wow, he's going to clean up. He's going to get a good job. He's going to cut his hair and we're going to be great. Yeah, no, that did not happen. I got long hair, purple strip, biker jacket, Megadeth t-shirt cut down to no man's land because I needed to fit in with him. So that's what really happened. You know, I was trying to join him. I don't know. And I drank and I got drunk and I blacked out and we went back to my place. And I can tell you that I was cavernous. I was so empty. I was soulless, and I not only could I not look at myself, but when I could, I saw nothing behind my own eyes, nothing. And I said to this man, what am I to you? And I tell you, with every fiber of my being, I wanted him to say, you are beautiful, and you are special, and I love you, and we're going to be together, and we're going to be married, and everything's going to be okay. He didn't say that. He said, we're going to always be friends. And I can tell you that I died 1,000 deaths in that moment. I died 1,000 deaths. I didn't tell him that. What I said was, that's cool. I wanted to make sure we were on the same page. I didn't want anybody getting out of the bed with feelings. Right? I can't let you know who I am. I couldn't let anybody know who I really was. I felt like I would disintegrate. I felt like I would annihilate and I would exist no more. And I knew, because I didn't want to take my own life, I knew in the depths of my soul that God had something different for me. I just couldn't figure it out. So when he left, I got up and I don't know if I washed my face and hands and cleaned myself. And I went back to my room. And I shut that door and I crawled onto the floor in a fetal position in the corner of the room and I sobbed a racking sob like I had never cried before. And I cried a lot. But this time it was different. It was much different. And I cried. And I said, God, please help me. I don't know what to do. Forever I was saying, God, why do I feel like this? Why don't you help me? Like this time I said something a little different. Like, God, what do you want me to do? And I got to tell you, I passed out. And when I came to, my life would never be the same. I got off that floor, whatever time it was in the next day, and I was itching my skin, and I was pulling at my hair, and I didn't know anything about delirium tremens. Nothing. I knew nothing about alcoholism withdrawal and DTs and the dangers of that. I knew nothing about it. But I was in the throes of the DTs. I know that today. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I need a drink. And I started ripping that place apart. And I could not find one bottle of beer, not one empty bottle of wine. There was no booze left to be had. There was nothing. And I started to get really, really, really scared. And I could not tell you why. Like, I still had not made the connection. I couldn't tell you why. Like, oh, my God, this is what it means to be alcoholic. You need a drink. I didn't make that connection. But I know that this thought came that crowded out everything else. And it said, Kim, call your sister. Now, I know that that didn't come from me because alcohol took my sister out of my life several years before. She said, like so many other people had said to me, Kim, it's too painful to love you. And I did not talk to her. Like, we didn't have a relationship. So, of course, I dismissed it as ludicrous. I was like, call my sister. What? And I just was like roaming around this condo, not knowing what to do. And it came again, and it was louder. It said, Kim, call your sister. And I was like, all right, talking to myself, you know, so I thought. And so I went to the phone, and I dialed my sister as if her phone number was on the tip of my fingertips. And she picked up the phone, and she said, Kim, we love you. Please come home. Yeah. And man, she taught me about loyalty because I had never been loyal. I had never been faithful in relationships. I had never been honest. I had never been loyal. I didn't know how to be a stand-up person. And she taught me in that moment how to be a stand-up human being, because despite all the harm I had caused to her, in the final analysis, she was there to help me. And I said to her, I'm doing all right. I'm okay. This is going to be all right. And she started to have a conversation with me. And I know she could hear it in my voice. My pride. Pride goeth before the fall. And I love that I get the opportunity to turn in all things to the Father of Light that presides over us all today. I love that I get that opportunity. Because I need that self, that destruction of self-centeredness. I need it. I need it like I need air. Like I need water, like I need sustenance. Like I do not want to ease God out of my life. I can, because I'm human. I don't want to in my heart of hearts today. And I was breaking up on the phone with her. And she said, I can't hear you, Kim. What's going on? And I looked down at my own two hands and I said, I'm packing a bag. I guess I'm coming home. And she said, let me pick you up. And I said, can you pick me up at the Philadelphia bus station? She didn't even know where it was. She said, where is that? And I told her. And she said, when will you be there? And I said, I don't know. And she said, I'm leaving now. And I can tell you it was daylight out when I talked to her. And it was blacker than it is out right now when I got there. And she was there. She never left. She got there and she stayed. She took me to my mother's house. And my mother was kind enough, despite the wreckage that I had caused in our relationship, to allow me to stay at her home. And I went to see my father the next day. And I could remember walking into my grandmother's house and my grandmother, like, being terrified of me and what I looked like. And knowing that my behavior was very unpredictable, like feeling threatened in her own home, in her own living room. And she asked me what I wanted, and I said, I need to see my dad. Because I can tell you today that I wanted him to put me in an inpatient mental facility for at least 1 year because I just knew that I had lost my mind. She said, he's at a meeting. And I said, what do you mean he's at a meeting? Who listens to him? And she said, she said, I don't know, but it's down on the avenue in Fernon. And can you bring him this paper? Because he forgot it and he has to get it signed. So my dad was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through the criminal justice system. And once he found his seat, he never left. And that night was January 23rd, 1994. And I went down to that meeting to meet up with him. And I never left. And I've not found an excuse valid enough to pick up a drink or any mind or mood altering chemical since that time. I can tell you that it was not an easy road. My defects of character do not go quietly into this great night. They, you know, sometimes they're like howling at the moon, you know what I mean? And I can promise you that I did nothing to earn my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is why I know I live in the grip of grace. You know, that is why I know that there is a loving and powerful hand of God at work in my life. Because he picked me right up off of that floor and brought me to the South Philadelphia group of Alcoholics Anonymous to ask my father to commit me. And in that meeting, I thought, I felt like that. I did that. Oh, my God, that person's crazy. I can't believe they're sharing that. And everybody's laughing at it. And I had to look up to see who this really courageous person was. And I saw a cup of coffee in this hand and a cigarette in this hand and smiles from ear to ear, and I knew I was home. And after that meeting, my father said, what do you want? And I said, this. And that was the second time in my life that I ever saw my father cry. The third time was when I shared my experience Dreaded Hope for the first time. And, but I can tell you that I learned very many things before I had the beautiful experience of Claire Keller taking me through the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that God kept me sober anyway because he knew in my heart that in that moment, I knew my life was unmanageable and that I was powerless over alcohol. And I had believed in him my whole life. And I knew in that moment that he had brought me there so that I can have another shot at this. And I gave my life to my higher power right there. And 1, 2, and 3, just I knew I was in. And I knew he was going to keep me in. Provided I did certain things, like it says in the doctor's opinion, provided we meet certain simple requirements. And I did not meet Claire Keller until I had 5 years sober. So I can tell you that I had the grace of God operating for 5 years in my ignorance. And I heard a lot of things like, just don't drink. And I heard a lot of things like, meeting makers make it. And I heard a lot of things like live easy but think first. And I heard AA is like a hula hoop. It doesn't work unless you're in the middle of it. I heard all these catchy little slogans that I fear sometimes today could kill a newcomer. But I know God kept me sober anyway. There's never a doubt in my mind because the message just wasn't there for me in the group that I got sober in. But people took time with me. And they gave me a hug, and they told me I better get up front, and they told me I should make the coffee that God was in the coffee pot. And I thought, what is going on with them? And I would look in the coffee pot. You know, like, what are they talking about? I didn't know that they were speaking in tongue, and they meant humble service to another person is where you will find your God. Like, I didn't know any of that. They were speaking a foreign language to me. But God kept me in this fellowship until Claire brought me into the fellowship of the Spirit with his direction. So I want to tell you that I have since, from 5 years and forward, I have since been through this Design for Living at least 4 or 5 times. And that's just for me. Because with every level of life, I mean, I live in 10, 11, and 12. I know what it means to live, you know, taking my inventory, you know, on the spot and in the morning and at night and obligated to take other women through the steps. I know. But as I evolve as a woman, more is revealed to me. And it is my life's endeavor to get closer to my higher power so that I can be better in service to Him and you. So if I got to go through again and learn more about me, then I'm more than willing to do it. I actually want to do it. Like, I don't know when that miracle happened for me. I know from the moment I hit that room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to hurt from alcohol anymore. And I wanted what you people had. I know from the moment that I went through the steps the first time that it was all about destruction of self-centeredness and being of maximum service to God and other people. And there was a lot of scary things I had to do, like face the people that I harmed. And make things right to the best of my ability, not say I'm sorry. It was evident how sorry I was at the bottom of my drinking. But making right the wrong to the best of my ability was my new work. And that was not easy. Simple, but not easy. A price has to be paid. They're not talking about the price I pay before I hit the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're talking about the price I pay to be reborn into a new way of living. You know, and into a new relationship with my Creator and all of His children. And that's where I would not want to be anywhere else. When I tell you, I wish I could rip open my chest and pour out all the love that I feel inside my person that I know is a direct pipeline from my higher power. Like, all I endeavor to do is be a hollow bone. All I want to do is love God, love life. Love others, move forward, press forward, be in service, give it away, and, you know, maybe I'll get a little bit of that back. Maybe. And that's just fine by me. I'm not the woman that I want to be, but I certainly ain't the woman that I was. So that's just fine by me. Thanks for letting me share.